everybody. It's Becky Brown with your February Club New Life Collective. You know, February is the month of love. We love our amazing Club New Life family, and you are the reason that so many lives are being changed. You are blessed to be a blessing. God is using your gifts and your support in ways that we may never know this side of heaven. So big thank you to start this collective. One of the newest things that we have launched this year is our New Life courses. We have designed a 12-week course for subjects like grief. We're going to launch one on divorce. We did our Lose It for Life. And the courses are a professional counselor leads the group of about 9 people through a 12-week curriculum and group connection. You know, group connection in general is one of our core values. And we wanted to provide a way for people to get the help that they need in ways that are, you know, that's easy to access. So you can do it at home. You can share the information with a friend, maybe do it with a friend. But we're going to continue to add to the topics and just keep your eye out for new life courses. And maybe you'll sign up for one. We hope to see you at our Club New Life family Zoom. It's February 3rd at 8 p.m. Eastern. And, you know, we love to see you face to face, even though it is virtual, but it's such a great way to connect and express our appreciation, to share what's happening behind the scenes at New Life, as well as feature a special teaching. Several of our past Zoom talks are on your Club New Life website if you'd like to check them out. Hope you find some time to join us for our next Zoom on February 3rd. Put it on your calendar now. Now let's start this collective with 2 teachings. First, we're going to hear from Mark Cameron, and he brings to the table thoughts on the importance of authenticity in relationship. And then Jackie McHarris will talk about re-traumatization. Let's listen.
Today, I want to talk about authenticity. So a couple of weeks ago, I ran out of the cologne that I liked, and I thought, you know what, let me see if I can get a deal because it's pretty expensive. And so I checked the local social media marketplaces, and I found someone pretty close to me who was selling the cologne that I liked. So messaged with him, made a deal, showed up there. He showed me the cologne. It was brand new, in the box package. I took it out. Checked it out, and then I went home, paid him, went home. He told me a reasonable story about how he got it and why he was getting rid of it. Got home, and then I compared it to the bottle that I had, and there were some slight differences. Mm. And I did some checking via Google, and there are people out there who will tell you how can you check and see if a cologne is real or fake, and it turned out it was fake.
Mm.
Aww.
But you know what? It got me thinking about the many people who jump into relationships quickly, thinking they've got the authentic article with someone, only to find out it crashes and burns. And in fact, somebody I know a few months ago emailed me, told me that they just got into a relationship with a new man. And she said, he's just so fantastic. And she just, you know, she asked me, you know, do you have any resources that will help this relationship grow? So I sent her. I suggested a couple of resources, but I also said, you know, make sure you look out for insecurities too, because in the initial phase of dating, there's this infatuation stage and where we idealize the other person, and we tend to have this bias where we will see things through a more positive light. Well, sure enough, just a couple of days ago, she emailed me and she started off with, "You were right." and this person, you know, it had been really good. But then he got into a stressful situation, and he went to stress response, and he shut her out, and that triggered her abandonment wounds, right? And so we find out a lot more about a person than by seeing them under stress than by seeing them relaxed. And so the Bible talks about our faith being tested by the refiner's fire in Malachi, and then in Proverbs talks about the Lord testing our hearts like the crucible for silver and the furnace for gold. Now, when you have precious metals and you want to cast them into new objects, you heat them to a very high heat, and that temperature burns off the impurities. Now, someone once said fire has 2 elements, that of burning and that of shedding light. And I think the same thing happens with stress. Yeah. It hurts, but it also sheds some light. So when you go on a date, next time you're planning a date with somebody who you're really excited about, think about asking some challenging questions, such as how did you contribute to the problems in your last relationship? What are you doing to work on this? Do you know your insecurities and triggers? What have you done to work on your reactivity? How do you resolve conflict? And for ladies, it's important to ask a man about his experiences with pornography and what he does to safeguard himself from it. Don't take easy answers like, that's not a problem for me. I don't do that anymore. He should be able to give you specifics about how he overcame that problem and the resources that he used and how he holds himself accountable. So don't be like me, only to discover you purchased an inauthentic article when it was too late. Do your homework first. And we got lots of resources at New Life to help you with that.
Absolutely. That's so good. I like to say it like this. You know, hang with a person until their best self wears off and the real self shows up. Because like many things, if I can tell on myself, back to some of these personality profiles and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. One of the Strength Finders things that I had in my profile was woo.
Woo? What does that mean?
woo just means this, is that I can come across as charming or personable or impressive. You know, wooing is a way to attract people.
Oh, got it.
Okay.
Yeah.
But the woo can be a fool's gold in the sense that, you know, again, what you see initially is maybe not what you get in the end. And I love this idea. I really, really loved. I was fascinated with the idea of stress test. You know, as heat is purifying, I'm like, anything that carries weight, anything that load bears, if it's going to be a thing of importance, it has to be stress tested. And so relationships will bear the load of life and experience in each other and pain, all of the things over a course of life. And have we stress tested our relationships? Have we stress tested ourselves to understand how we respond in certain situations?
Do you know, I think the question I came up with, Mark, was, sorry for what I said when I was hungry. Sorry for what I said when I was stressed. You know, when you think about those stressful situations, any of us can be our best selves without any pressure.
Yes.
But it's when the pressure comes and learning to create space. This is work that I've done on my own self. Friends may disagree, but no, I'm working really hard at creating that space, just where those points of stress, you know, everything from when you have to wait longer than you thought you expected to wait, right? And then if you're in a romantic relationship, I've been in a romantic relationship for 40 plus years with my husband, but it's interesting because in the dating scene, we call it love bombing, right? Where you have somebody that comes in and they're just the greatest thing ever, and you know they could do no wrong, and we all know that that's not true. We're humans, and we're going to do wrong. But boy, when you can figure out what those stressors are and how you can create space and breathe, you just feel better. You don't have to say you're sorry as much. I mean, it's really a powerful tool to really understand how our reactions make a difference.
Well, it's important that we recognize the idealization phase that, every relationship, every romantic relationship goes through the stage. Research shows us that. And it can last actually up to 2 years. I think for most people, it doesn't last that long. That's a long time. But you find out a lot, we tend to go on dates and we create this excitement and we want to see about commonalities and do we enjoy the same things. But really, I think the proof of how strong a relationship is going to be and how it's going to last is when you see somebody under stress. Because like you were saying, Chris, I think we all kind of have this woo factor about us. Whatever the creativity that we have, we all have strengths and talents, and people will find those attractive. Mm-hmm. But it's learning to see, how does somebody handle stress? You know, what are their triggers? We all have triggers. We all have core wounds that we've gained, and so it takes an incredible amount of insight to be able to look at yourself into the mirror and see that. And it also takes an incredible amount of vulnerability to be able to share with someone who you are excited about some of your flaws and some of the things that you struggle with.
And I think another factor of that is it is the things that we are attracted to in other people are typically not the things that are sustainable to relationship over a lifetime. And so attraction and relationship are two different things. And sometimes we get blinded by the fact that those are not synonymous. You know, they can be, but they but it's a very dangerous assumption.
Well, and oftentimes the thing that we're attracted to is the thing that we're lacking in ourselves. You know, when we first got married, my wife said to me, and we didn't realize she had ADHD, but she said to me, you know, I love how, you know, so organized you are, and I want you to teach me that, right? And then later on, it's like, you're so rigid.
Yes.
You know, yep. You're not spontaneous enough,
yep. Yeah.
Right? And so we flip to the other end, and we devalue. You know, when you idealize, you're going to tend to flip the other way at some point and then devalue.
Yeah, that's really good.
You know what's fun about that is that in this day and age of social media where you see what you think is reality in somebody else's life, it may not be accurate, but we're doing the same thing even in our interpersonal relationships, right? We want to put our best foot forward. What is the one thing, though, when you talk about core wounds, though, Mark, how do you recognize core wounds? Because you could always blame it on somebody else, right?
Well, and blaming is a defense strategy. It's typically when people blame, it's because they have a lot of shame. It's hard for them to look at at their flaws. And, you know, you guys know that I am a large proponent of attachment-based therapy, and because the neuroscience, the research proves this, that the homes that we grow up in impact us.
Yes.
We learn everything about relationships that we know as we go into adulthood from our families of origin, the families that we grow up in. And so how we go about getting our needs met or our expectations about those or you know, do our emotions get recognized? Are they welcomed? Do we receive comfort? From these experiences, we either get a positive experience or we get a negative experience. And whenever we get a negative experience, from both, we form beliefs. But from negative experiences, we form negative self-beliefs. And so some of those self-beliefs could be like, I'm not worthy, or my voice doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And so it's learning how to look at that to see when those things come out in the present. And so usually when you get triggered, when you get upset, if you take a moment to pause and think about what just happened just then, and has that happened to me before, and how did I react in childhood when this happened? Now, how did my parents address these things with me, you'll probably start to see some historical links.
Well, and that just comes to the realization and the truth that we don't come out of the womb knowing how to do relationship.
Oh, correct.
There's this weird thing. We come out as deeply relational beings. We have to have connection or we don't survive. But we learn how to relate over a lifetime. And the thing I always like to say is that if you're with a person and you haven't read the previous chapters, you're going to have a hard time relating to them in their current chapter, you know?
Well, you know, but you know what, Chris, though, when you say, I love that, we learn to relate over a lifetime. But I would also say, but do we? A lot of times we get stuck in that blame or that pain.
Absolutely. And in that blame and that pain, you're like you said, it's a shame response. It's to offload the stuckness, to offload this lack of solution to the problem that I'm experiencing. And that's where I see a lot of people have this blame or underneath that, as you said, this core belief that I am fundamentally flawed or, you know, and it sounds like I'm unworthy, I'm not good enough, I'm unlovable, I don't have what it takes, whatever the case may be, that makes me unsavory to another person and rejection inevitable. And so if we don't know that those things are happening inside of us, you know, I use this analogy all the time. It's like a landmine with a tripwire. And you're going to walk through my tripwire and I'm going to explode. And then we're going to wonder why it's such a painful experience.
Well, and we all have those core wounds. So that's when I was talking about learning to ask these questions. People should have answers to these questions. If you've done the growth work, you should be able to pinpoint where you struggle in life and where you hurt and how you get reacted. And if you don't, you know, that's an area of growth for you. You need to develop what I like to term, I didn't come up with this term, but the observing self, the active part of self-awareness that you look inside to ask what happened and why did that happen.
That's so important. What happened? Why did it happen? How did it impact me, or how did it form me in my relationships? You know, we take these things that are seemingly frustrating and mysterious. You know, I'm baffled that I keep running into this problem over and over and over again. My anxiety is so sticky. My depression is so stubborn. My relationships just can't seem to work. Or my emotional life just seems really, really chaotic. I'm like, yes, well, one, welcome to the human condition. You know, we're glad that you're here. Been a card-carrying member since 1975. So with that said, the challenge is that we over time can adopt this thing like there is nothing I can do about that. Mm-hmm. And we know here at New Life that is fundamentally untrue. In fact, I would say that that is a message from the pit of hell. Like, this is like, you know, maybe we can't get to full healing and restoration because this ain't heaven.
Right.
But we can absolutely move the needle.
I'm reading a book called Thanks for the Feedback. And so learning how to receive feedback. And as I'm thinking about how people deal with trauma and grief, I realize that oftentimes one of the ways we re-traumatize people is with the feedback that we give.
Oh, yeah.
And the ways in which we receive feedback. And so I may give you feedback and not know your story.
Yes.
And the feedback I give you then re-traumatizes you. And now we're in this relational struggle because I stepped on a landmine I didn't know was there. Mm. And so the importance of doing your work and being willing to have conversations with a therapist to start, some safe person, a therapist, a pastor, your partner, but someone who is safe that you can tell your story to, that can know where you've been and what's happened. And if you can, I feel like if we do some of that work, then when we encounter someone giving us feedback, we're better able to receive it because it doesn't trigger those old wounds as much.
We're either able to extract the landmines or we're able to diffuse the landmines.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. I just had a client this week come back because I had shared something in session and I told a story. Instead of just being direct with her about what I was observing. And what I love about what she shared is that she came back to me and told me how my feedback had left her with some negative feelings.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
That was so brave, right? Because, and I told her, I said, you know, communication lies in the one that's communicating. I take full responsibility. And if I said something and didn't communicate in a way that felt safe or good, I want to redo, right? Yeah. And so I appreciate what you're saying, Jackie, about feedback. And
I love the way you received that feedback. It was such a great way of modeling for her and making it okay.
Yeah.
Right? Because you're in what she might consider an authority position, and yet she could come back to you. There's been so much safety created there that she could come back and say, hey, that hurt.
Yeah.
That's so, so good. Because it just reminds me that our response to pain, our response to rupture, our response to grief is to naturally go invulnerable, right? Mm-hmm. To push away and to close off and defend and shut down. But our need, the irony is our need in our healing process is the need to become vulnerable, is to open up. And so we're in this tension here. But to your point, Jackie, we need a safe place to do that. To be vulnerable to the right things, to be vulnerable to the safe, the healing, and the good things that allows to unearth the landmines and start the process of extracting them so that you can be more healthy in the world, or at least, like I say, diffuse them.
They can be diffused.
Yeah.
Our first call to share from New Life Live is with Chris Williams, Dr. Jackie Mack Harris, and Dr. Sherry Keffer. They're weighing in on Maria's question, how do I know if my husband is a narcissist? Dr. Sherry Keffer follows the call with a discussion on boundaries. Don't we all need them?
We're going to go right back to the phones. We're going to talk to Maria in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania on WBYN. Maria, how's it going today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing good. Now that you're with us, tell us what's going on and how we can help you.
Well, thank you for taking my call. My question is, after 30 years of marriage, how do I know if I'm married to a narcissist?
Well, let me ask you the question. What's inside of you, or what you are you experiencing that makes that a question for you?
I'm confused.
Okay.
I'm constantly feeling like my head is spinning as to what just happened. Something will happen. I will question what happened, and it comes right back at me. Well, I did this and I did that, and
so Maria, if you were to bring up an issue of concern to your husband, what you experience is that issue will either get flipped back on you, or that you will be questioned about your experience of the issue. Is that correct?
It usually starts by flipping it back on me.
Okay.
And then I get upset. And then the next response is, well, see how irrational and overreactive you are. This is the problem. You always flip out.
Okay. Maria, so when you bring something to him, you're upset and you have in mind what's gone on. And you tell him, and his response to you is kind of defensive, and he's telling you all the things that you do, and now it's something you must have made, that if you hadn't done that, this wouldn't have happened. And then you said you're upset. When you're upset, is this like yelling and screaming, dysregulated? Can you hear his answer if he were to give you a clear, straight answer, or are you at that point so flooded that you need a particular answer?
It takes more than that to get me flooded.
Okay.
And flown off the handle. My first reaction is, we need to talk about what just happened or what happened yesterday. I don't like what happened because of XYZ. I don't think it was fair that you, ABC. Well, that's just your opinion. Well, that's the way you see it, but that's wrong, because that's not what happened. I'm told I'm wrong. I'm told I'm stupid.
So this is what I would say, Maria, and I am I'm absolutely heartbroken that this is happening to you. There's a term out there, it's called DARVO, D-A-R-V-O. And DARVO is a form of psychological abuse. So the D stands for deny the behavior. So when you go to confront someone, like you go to talk to him about this issue, ABC, whatever, D is deny the behavior. Okay. He denies it. A is attack the one who's confronting you. R is reverse. V is victim and offender. O is offender. So it's deny the behavior, attack the one that's confronting you, and reverse the victim and the offender role. So you end up being the one that's the biggest offender. He goes into the victim position where he gets power. Now, because of that psychological abuse, we get really spun out. And you can begin to feel very confused. You can begin to question your own reality. You begin to question what just happened. It impacts your self-image. It actually can cause you to become more depressed. It actually can cause you to isolate, pull away. And you can become very, very weary.
And you asked, how do you know if you're married to a narcissist? I think a more important question is, what do you need to be okay? Because whether he's a narcissist or not, you've got to figure out a way to take care of you in this situation. And we wouldn't be able to diagnose him, but I can tell you that Google can probably give you a list of criteria and you can check them off as you're experiencing them. Are you by any chance in therapy? Do you have someone that you meet with regularly that you can talk about and process this?
I pursued it as far as finding someone and setting up an appointment, and because of the financial, I had to convey that I was going, and he said, well, it's good because you're obviously mentally ill, so it'll do you a lot of good. Didn't go.
No, no, no. Don't. Yeah, well, that's where he trips you up. He took your opportunity from healing away from you by making you think you're crazy. And you were like, well, then no, go and let him pay for it.
So Maria, there is this definitely DARVO thing going on, this denial, attack, reverse victim offense.
It's abuse.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
It's relational and psychological abuse.
Absolutely. And as a result, there's this other term, gaslighting, which is there to question your reality. And DARVO is his playbook. Okay. This is damaging to you, damaging to the relationship, and is the crisis that you feel that it is. And so, to Jackie's point, I think you need to keep going on your healing and health journey. Yeah. And then learn to set boundaries. We're going to send you a copy of The Emotionally Destructive Marriage by Leslie Vernick. That's going to really help open your eyes to what's really going on. But you need people around you to strengthen you and to encourage you and lead you through this emotional abuse that you are experiencing.
Sherry, what is on your mind and what would you like to share with everybody?
Yeah, well, you know, I have been wrestling with and thinking about boundaries myself, wrestling with them. And I know boundaries, to me, boundaries feel like a slippery bar of soap that you keep trying to grab and it drops on the bottom of the bathroom floor. It's like, what? Why are these so hard? And I think there's a couple of reasons. I think the first reason is someone does something that hurts us, and our reaction would be to do something back that would hurt them. Like, and when I mean hurt them, I mean punish them. Like, but boundaries are not about punishment. Boundaries are actually about protection. They're about how can I love myself, protect myself, care for myself right now from this person that's really hurting me. Now, that's part two of the challenge, is we have to stop for a moment and we have to ask ourselves this mystery question, because most of us that struggle with boundaries also struggle with knowing what we need. We struggle with saying, what do I need? How can I care for myself? Because we feel selfish when we do that. And usually those of us that struggle with boundaries are selfless. We get into situations where we're like speed bumps in people's lives. So ask yourself the question, what do I need to feel safe? What do I need to feel loved? What do I need to feel supported? What is the thing that's hurting you? And when you figure out what you need, like, let's say I need safety. Well, guess what? Safety is worth protecting yourself for. So if somebody is hurting you, you might try to make them make your situation safe, but they're not. You've got to figure out how to make yourself safe. And that's going to create impact on the other person. Now, some people use the word consequences, and that's fine. But I think when you think about it, like, there's an impact that the other person's going to feel. They're going to feel disrupted. They're going to feel frustrated. They're going to feel like they don't like what you're doing, not because you're punishing them, but because you're actually working to protect yourself. So think about it. Where are you feeling like you're a speed bump in somebody's life right now? And How might you protect yourself? And then you've got to be willing to do whatever it takes, right? If you don't do this, then I'm going to do this. And whatever that impact is, you've got to follow through, because if you don't, they don't respect us. So what do you think?
I love it. And I love the question, what do I need? Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of times when we are asking that of ourselves, we haven't sat with ourselves long enough to really understand what we do need. On this call, Chris Williams, Dr. Alice Benton, and Mark Cameron address Elijah's difficulty in bouncing back after his wife's affairs. Then our new radio host, Brian Perez, joins Dr. Jill Hubbard and Jim Burns as they connect with Anne. She's a caller who's struggling with anxiety with all of life's potholes and now coping with her husband's cancer diagnosis. There are some tough situations out there, and we're so grateful to be answering these calls.
Elijah, calling from Washington, D.C., listening on WAVA. Elijah, tell us what's happening in your life today.
Yeah, how are you today?
Good, good. How are you doing?
Yeah. All right. I just calling in. I just had a quick question. This is dealing with the, I guess, the rebuilding part after your spouse has an affair.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife had an affair, not just one, but she had two. It's like you tried to come back into the relationship the same way. You left still, you know, lying and stuff like that. But I went to counseling to try to get, you know, some help. But more of the counseling was kind of like, what did you do wrong? You had to do something wrong for this person to do that.
It was like,
people just, women just don't normally do that. You had to do, and I was trying to tell them if you listen to her. And so when I try to tell her how I feel, she cuts me off. It's like as soon as I start explaining it, she'll just cut me off and be like, oh, that's just, you know. So it kind of blew over, and everyone was like.
So was that hold on, let me jump in, Elijah. So clarity, was it the therapist who was cutting you off or your wife who was cutting you off?
My wife who was cutting me off.
Okay.
She still does that today.
Okay, yeah. So let me jump in here really quickly because I want to address the therapy thing first. So it sounds like you encountered victim shaming 101, you know, and that's where we blame the victim for what the perpetrator did, right? And that's incredibly damaging because you are being gaslit, you're being deceived into saying that you are responsible for another person's painful actions towards you. So I just want to make sure that that's clear. The reason I can say this with full confidence is because there can be lots of problems in relationships, but saying an affair is the solution to the problem is actually part of the problem. And so I just want to clarify to let you know that you got really bad counsel there, and I have no problem saying that.
I knew that.
That's good. That's good. Yeah.
When I'm sitting in counseling, I was like, this is not right.
Yes.
You know, one of the counselors was saying, well, she's not doing it now. And I said, whether or not she's not doing it now, it's the mindset.
It's like, that's so bananas. It's like, I punched you in the face three times, but I'm not doing it right now. It doesn't make any sense. Yeah.
So I'm glad you figured that out.
So since that day, you know, pretty much the counsel we have is like, you just need to put it behind you and move on and you learn how to forgive.
Whoa, man. We got to get you some better counsel, man.
So where are you stuck here, Elijah? Is it you're stuck that the last counseling said, put it behind you and move on?
Well, it's like,
what's your question?
I've been praying about it. And my question is like navigating, where to navigate from here, because that scenario, how it starts, the rebuilding process starts, it makes my spouse think that, that the behavior, not that it's doing that, but the cutting off, the dishonoring.
Okay, so
talk is like, I'm the problem.
Yeah, so Elijah, let me jump in here. any problem that is not directly confronted only grows. This is a major, major problem, right? The affairs. And you're healing, you said it well, you're dealing with a betrayal trauma. To deny that trauma and to deny the problem and to not address it is to only keep it alive and growing. And so it's really important if a person, you know, because I get to have this conversation, unfortunately, with more oftentimes males all the time. It's like, you've got to take full ownership head on of what you've done. No denying it, no minimizing it. It's got to be owned. And then you've got to really do the work on the repair. And any couple who's been through a betrayal trauma, infidelity, this isn't a hard and fast number, and it's not magical, but it's a principle. I tell them this, you've got to put 7 years in your back pocket right now, because it takes a long time to restore trust to get the relationship back to a secure foundation in that. Mark, where do you take Elijah from here?
Yeah, Elijah, my heart goes out for you as someone who myself has been on the receiving end of betrayal and having to help other people too. Now, what I do know is that when betrayal has happened, you need to heal that wound. And so you have to go through betrayal recovery. If you don't go through betrayal recovery, you can't rebuild the relationship, because a key part of betrayal recovery is for each of the individual partners to recover. The betrayed partner needs to heal, and they only heal by being able to let out their hurt and feel safe. And the unfaithful partner only recovers when they can take ownership and understand why they did what they did, and empathize and validate and make the betrayed partner feel safe again. If that doesn't happen, then you're not going to be able to rebuild your relationship. That is a key part to this. So what I would say for you is find someone. Let us help put you in touch with somebody who is skilled in betrayal recovery. And that's the direction that I would take. Because you can't just sew up a wound that is infected and expect that it's going to heal. It's not. It's going to keep on rupturing.
Absolutely. So, Elijah, we're going to send you a copy of Intimate Deception, Healing the Wounds of Sexual Betrayal. Know that that's written typically from a wife's perspective, but I have recommended and had so many of my men that I've worked with in your situation, and this book has been incredibly helpful for them to understand what's going on inside of them, and what they need. So, Elijah, thank you so much for calling in. I want to remind men out there that may be struggling in sexual acting out that this causes unbelievable and unspeakable amounts of pain to anyone that you're in relationship with, to the people that you're participating with, and incredible amounts of damage to yourself. If this is a pattern in your life, I want you to discover freedom. And this is the time to do it. For we know that so many men who have benefited from attending every man's battle. If you're thinking about it, actually, today's the day to do it. Today is the day to sign up. We've helped thousands of men find freedom from sexual acting out, and we want you to experience that same freedom. You can go to newlife.com to register for every man's battle, or you can just give us a call at 1-800-NEW-LIFE.
Anne, thank you for calling in today, Anne.
So I guess my question is, I'm just struggling to, you know, find my way in this new season. There's my husband, it's not been a year yet, has been diagnosed with a rare form of cancer, which they tell us is not curable, but they have different treatments to kind of keep it at bay. Our empty nest is no longer empty. We have our youngest that just moved home after college, which was an invitation on our part to kind of get himself established. And so that's a change. I'm going through the change of life myself. And I just go back and forth. I feel like I'm strong on certain days, very clear. And other days, I don't know what to do with myself. I resigned from my position to kind of be with my husband and take care of some things. And I'm completely comfortable with being the homemaker. And my husband is very, very supportive and helps me all the time. He's appreciative, couldn't do this without me. And I just, you know, I'm a little lost, and I don't know how to process my emotions sometimes, and I feel like I can take me for a ride. Hmm. I'm a strong believer. We're both believers. We know the truth, and yet I feel like I get just snagged away with lies, and I feel sometimes really guilty because everyone wants to know, how's he doing? How's he doing? And I feel invisible sometimes, and I feel like really guilty for that because I'm not the one that sick, as though I tell everyone I'm sick too, because we'll be married 35 years, and when she's sick, I'm sick.
Yeah.
So it's happening to me too, and it's just a lot, and I don't know what to. I just.
Well,
I have people that are supportive. I have friends; they do ask about me, and people do ask, "How are you doing?" I have someone that meets with me every other week who's walked a similar road with her husband. And an illness, and so God has provided, and yet I still feel lost.
Well, and Anne, I'm so sorry you guys are in this position, but Anne, part of you feeling lost is because you can't know the future, right? You're on a new path that you have some ideas about, and it's a different path than you thought you would be on. And what our minds tend to do is race ahead with our fear and worry and, predict the worst. And because we can't control all of that, there's that tendency to feel lost. Like, what do I do? It does sound like you're doing some really good things. You've made some changes in your life to accommodate what is happening. You've got supportive people. You're meeting some people on a regular basis. And the thing is, every day is going to be a little bit different. And you're having to be in the moment with the new challenges that get presented. And I think it's turning that worry, back, 100 times a day towards God. We've got to turn worry into prayer, right? Something I've been thinking about that I may share on another show is that worry is really like inverted prayer. It's us like trying to figure out for ourselves without God. And so we've got to include God in that process and turn it back towards Him. And you aren't God, you aren't all-knowing and all-present and all-powerful, so you can't know the outcome. But sometimes all you know is what's right now and what's right in front of you. And that is how He's asking you to live right now.
When Jesus said, live one day at a time, that it becomes real when there's as much change. And I'm thinking about something. First of all, I am so sorry for all you're going through. And it's called change, lots and lots of change. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, a lot of your change is, kind of slapping you across the face. I have a mentor who wrote something called the Roan stress test, stress and anxiety test. And I just, as you mentioned, that your husband was diagnosed with cancer, empty nest, no longer empty, change of life, job change. I mean, it could honestly be a birthday, but they give numbers to that. And you just went way over this. And there's really nothing, you have nothing you can do with that. So sometimes you just have to look at yourself and go, you know what? I deserve to have a little bit of anxiety because I'm getting thrown this way. You described so well what we would suggest to anybody who is going through some of this. You have a small group. You have this woman who's walking through, You're incredible. Yeah, exactly. You're incredibly authentic. You're a believer. You're leaning into the Lord. I think you're doing what you're doing. The results are still unknown, as Jill said. And so the results are in the hands of God. And sometimes we just have to curl up and say, God, I relinquish my will to your will, and you seem to be doing a lot better than I'm doing, God, and come and comfort me. Because honestly, you have so much change, it's not going to be easy. There's no easy fix to this. But you're doing what we would suggest people to do. So you're going to get through this. It's not going to be easy. And you're going to have bumps on the road.
I do love what you said. When you're married, whatever your spouse is going through, you are going through it too.
Right. And with her spouse, she said invisible. I sometimes feel invisible. And then, and you, in some ways, and you corrected yourself because you said, no, people are asking me and whatnot. But I think there's a lot of times when you're caring for a loved one that we feel invisible. And I think a lot of people who are trying to help.
Well, because the attention and people don't know how to help or how to comfort. And so it's easy to say, well, what's happening medically?
Yeah. And
what's the latest?
Yeah. And that's why what I liked about Anne saying she has other relationships, because she has to be visible to somebody.
Yeah.
And when she's visible to even one or two other, you know, people kind of surrounded in her life, that's going to help her through that, because you are kind of invisible when you're doing that. I get it. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's really normal that you would be feeling all of these things.
Right.
I don't know why you feel guilty for feeling these things.
No, right. That's it. What I was trying to get across was, no, this is, unfortunately, this is, you know, life's not easy. Life's sometimes hard. And this is life.
Yeah.
And it's a hard life. And Anne, I believe in you. Just listening to you, I think you're amazing. And I think you are building a foundation of strength for all the changes that are going through. So God bless you.
Our last call to share this month is Eve. She asks Chris, Dr. Jill, and Mark if it would be wise or detrimental for her to share with her teenage daughter and son about her own teenage sexual regrets. Then our final teaching segment features Mark Cameron on codependency.
We're going to go to Eve listening in Atlanta, Georgia through our app. Eve, how you doing?
Hey, I have a 16-year-old daughter and an 18-year-old son. Is there ever a benefit in disclosing my teenage sexual years to my daughter, especially?
Yeah.
I mean, is there ever, you know, to disclose it and say I regret it? And would that be a good deterrent? Would I just don't know. Like, or is it a big hard no? Don't.
Yeah. Oh, Eve, that's a fantastic question.
I understand the tension here, Eve. I've got two 19-year-old kids, so I understand the age. And I remember going through some of the struggle too in my mind. You know, do I talk to them about it, and how much of that would be, you know, a cautionary tale versus a license, you know, an implicit message to, like, hey, I did it. It's okay for you to go and do it and make the mistake. Is that what's going on inside of you? Is that what the tension is?
No, my tension is definitely as a deterrent to add another angle of what she might be exposed to with her bajillion friends doing this and that. My daughter does not have a boyfriend that I know of, but as I was on the break, over the break, I started thinking, okay, this is more about me and dealing with my own thing, or maybe on the side and not projecting, I don't know, transferring it over, but
That's good. I'm glad you got that. Yes. So you have no fear that if you self-disclose to her that she might take that as a license that she can go ahead.
Make a mistake too.
And make a mistake too.
I tend to think that if anything, it would add value, but I don't want to do the wrong thing, and you can't take it back after that.
Well, you can't. So here's what I would say. I would say that dialogue with your kids is a really, really good thing, right? And you don't want to be a single topic parent either. So what I would say to you is, you know, ask you this question, what's your relationship like with her, and what's your dialogue like with her in other areas of life?
I speak with her as much as I can. As far as our love languages, I'm the huggy one and she's the cold one, sort of. So I feel like I'm kind of, you know, tiptoeing around doing the best I can to give her love in the way she needs. I feel like she would listen, and I don't know, I feel like there's more value of saying there's regret, you know, but I don't know.
So sometimes in the teenage years, kids can be like that. They can seem like they're really cold. Mm-hmm. I would encourage you to keep leaning in. I mean, you want to respect her boundaries for her bodily autonomy. You know, you don't want to hug her if she does want a hug. But I do remember telling my daughter before, hey, it's a one hug a day thing. So you choose when you get the hug. It's either in the morning or it's in the evening. I just want to give you a hug. So it's a one hug a day. And she, you know, she leaned into that, and it started off being, you know, a 1-second hug. And now she gives me a hug every night. And sometimes it's a 10-second hug. So kids need that. What I would say is dialogue is a good thing. When you tell her about, you know, the things that happened with you, I would also talk about not just your regret, but also how it made you feel. And then follow up with good questions. You know, what are some of the pressures that you see happening? You know, do you feel strong enough to say a no at times? And if she doesn't, then even role play with her if she's comfortable doing that. But just understand that this is going to be an ongoing dialogue. Sex should be an ongoing dialogue with a kid, not just a single conversation.
Well, and Eve, I think to be in a place, I like that. That is so true. So you want to create and facilitate the ability to have these kinds of conversations. But I want you to think about, it's less about you talking and it's more about you drawing her out, especially with the dynamic that you described. And I certainly had some of that with my daughter. And so you have to capitalize on the times when they are willing to talk and often and not try to push it at times when it's convenient for you. And then where does she talk more? Is it when you guys are out of the house, maybe doing something together, driving in the car? Like, be aware of those types of things. And you want to hear what she thinks about things. So it needs to be less about your need to share this as a deterrent, but more about, does it fit into the flow of our conversation? And would it be a good point here at this juncture? And I even at one point with my kids talked about, well, how would it feel to you if you knew that I did or I didn't? And we talked about both variables. What would that be like for you in terms of helping you and kind of asking her, you know, what she needs from you in terms of navigating all of this.
I'm curious, though, Eve, you said that you were thinking that it might be your issue. What is the issue that you were thinking it might be for you?
You know, just dealing with that of regrets and everything around it. And I do have a therapist through you guys, so this is something meeting with her tomorrow.
That's awesome.
This is something I will bring up tomorrow. But there is that, but Jill, that when you said both scenarios, inevitably, wouldn't they ask, well, what is it, Mom? What did you, which one are you on?
Well, and that's what you have to, you know.
But that's great because now they're asking you a question. Yeah. They're learning to draw you out, and now it becomes a dialogue rather than a monologue. A lot of times we want to correct and teach, and sometimes we forget to listen.
So yeah,
right. Doing that,
and that's the point, because the thing is that our stories are not deterrents for our kids, and they will pick up that that's a form of control rather than genuine connection to them. So what Jill is doing is saying, hey, let's connect on this rather than me controlling your sexual behavior out of my fear. That's the thing we want to let go of. So Eve, we're going to also send you a copy of Jim Burns' book, Student's Guide to Sexual Integrity, because that can be very helpful in bringing up some of these topics and conversations.
So I want to talk about the codependency today. So in almost every show, we get a call about codependency. It's somebody who's stuck with an adult kid or a spouse, and they're in this cycle. Now, what keeps people stuck is fear. It's fear the other person will either hurt themselves, become homeless, commit suicide, hurt another person, get deeper into the addiction, or go back to their affair partner. Now, you see the commonality here. It's fear what the other person will do, what the taker will do if the giver doesn't keep rescuing. Now, when fear drives the bus, it doesn't take us to the destination of recovery. Now, I'm not promoting this show here, but it's something that stuck in my memory that I saw a few years ago as a good illustration. It was an old episode of The Simpsons where Homer's trying to get a soda can out of a vending machine. It doesn't fall, so he sticks his arm up in there to try and reach it, and his arm gets stuck. And the fire department come out, and after a while, they say, Homer, one of them says, Homer, is your arm stuck because you won't let go of the soda can? And obviously, that's what's happening. And this is the good illustration, is because people are stuck in codependency. They're chained to their circumstance because they refuse to let go of the outcome, even though they actually have no control over the outcome. So there's an acronym how the taker keeps the giver codependent, and it's called FOG, and that stands for fear, obligation, and guilt. And that's how they keep that person stuck in the cycle of codependency. Now, often the growth for the person who's the addict or the taker, that only happens when we allow the crisis to occur. Mm-hmm. Alice, you shared on a show last week that oftentimes you've seen it's only when someone was actually made homeless or yes. whatever the circumstance happened that they actually change. Now, 2 Timothy 1:7 says, "For God did not give us a spirit of fear and timidity, but a power, love, and self-discipline." So what does it look like to act from a place of love rather than fear? Well, we need to change our thinking. There's 3 C's of dealing with an addict in Alcoholics Anonymous, and the 3 C's are this: I didn't cause it, I can't control it, I can't cure it. And they also have something called the 5 G's of dealing with an addict, and this is about taking an action. This is where the power, love, and self-discipline comes in. The 5 G's stands for get off their back, so stop trying to fix it, help them, tell them what they need to do. Get out of their way. Don't put yourself in a situation where they're going to be reactive and you're going to get hurt. Give them to God. Get to a meeting, and this is for yourself, to work on your own recovery for your part in the codependency cycle, and then get on with your life. Accept that it may not get better. It's out of your control. So if you're struggling, my encouragement to listeners are, if you're struggling with this, give us a call today. Call 1-800-NEW-LIFE. Come to our website. We got resources that can help you with this.
Yep.
Brian, could I comment on what
you
Mark
may.
Shared with
yes.
us? Because I was thinking that when parents know they've been imperfect and then their adult child struggles with any of the things Mark was listing out, because of parental imperfection, we can feel responsible. Well, it's my fault my child is struggling with addiction because we divorced, because we were too angry in the home. And so I have to keep rescuing to make up for what I did wrong.
Right.
And there are hints of truth to that, because our parental behavior influences our children's health, but we're not responsible for them. We're responsible to them. But when parents are willing to clean up their side of the street, make apologies, make admissions to their adult children who are struggling, it does help in the healing process on both sides. So I want to give the reassurance to you parents that it's right to look at what you did. It's right to make apologies. But then we have to make this separation that Mark is describing to us, that to truly love our children well, we need that tough love. We need to allow consequences to occur.
And that's the obligation and the guilt in that FOG acronym
yes.
that keeps people rescuing.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for praying for all of our callers as they share their lives with us and the difficulties that they face. I know that we all learn as we hear them ask the questions. At least I do. I learn something every time I listen. And we thank you for your steady, consistent, amazing support. Club New Life truly is the backbone of all parts of this ministry. And we're reaching out to so many people. And in this world, I think we all need a little bit more support. You make a difference each and every month, and we're including a testimony for you. I hope you know that your partnership changes lives. Just listen to this one.
Hi, my name is Karen, and I absolutely love this program. I'm from Auburn, California. I came across this station about 6 years ago, and I listen to the radio program every morning. I love all the hosts, and I was tickled to hear Becky Brown's voice on my voicemail. Really makes an impact on my life, all of the things I learned. And probably the funniest thing is when people call in for questions, now I try to answer them and see if I'm right, because I've been listening to you for so long. I refer this resource to friends, family, and acquaintances. And I used to run or facilitate a divorce and relationship recovery group in the Bay Area, and I would always refer to this program for help. So please keep doing what you're doing. Thank you for all you do.
We would love to hear from you. If you'd like to share your testimony, or if you have a question to ask on New Life Live, call 1-888-NEW-LIFE or 1-888-639-5433. And leave your question or testimony on a recording. We can't wait to hear from you. And of course, I want you to know about upcoming events. We have Everyman's Battle, February 28th through March 2nd in Orange County, California. April 25th through 27th in Washington, D.C., and Intimacy and Marriage, February 14th through 16th in Orange County, California. And can I say one thing about Intimacy and Marriage? It is the best way to celebrate Valentine's Day, no matter what state your marriage is in, literally and emotionally. We want you to have a great marriage. And so come and join us at Intimacy and Marriage in Orange County, California, February 14th through 16th. These last few days, we've been seeing the video footage of the fire devastation in California. And one donor who lives in that area shared it was like someone dropped a bomb. And we also heard stories from the hurricane damage in North Carolina, where people are still living in tents trying to recover the devastation. There's always something that we're facing. And yet we can know that God is with us even in these challenges. It reminds me of Jeremiah walking through the rubble of Jerusalem after its fall. It's recorded in Lamentations 3, 22 through 23. And this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. Because of the Lord's great love, we are not consumed, for his compassions never fail. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. Even in these challenges and these dark hours, whatever you're facing, there is hope in Christ. Regardless of whatever struggle you might be in, could be a fire, could be broken relationships, betrayal, challenges with a job or your children, there is hope in Christ. If you need help, you know where to find us. Call us. And even if you just would remember to pray for the people that you're helping each and every month, it will make a difference in their lives.